of what was actually written. So this should be on your chairs. Most of you should have a copy of a gospel. Is that what Matthew, Mark, Luke or John actually wrote, or has it been tampered with? Were they people who could have known the truth, or were they writing hundreds of years later? And the final question we'd like to know the answer to is it true? But the trouble is that third question isn't strictly a historical question. Dragging you back to GCSE history maybe. You never actually say, is it true? The kind of questions you really ask are these ones. Do we have reason to trust them? And can we corroborate what they say? So that's the structure of what we'll do this evening. Do we have what they wrote, or has it been changed? Were they people who could have known? And then do we have any reasons to trust them? And can we check what they said? That's roughly the structure we're going to follow. And interesting, there's a quote from Richard Dawkins at the top there, from his book, The God Delusion, which is a lot of fun to read, sort of full of clear things and striking, strong things to say. Here's one of them. The fact that something is written down is persuasive to people not used to asking questions, basically, thick people like me, Christians, who questions like, who wrote it and when? How did they know what to write? Did they in their time really mean what we understand them to be saying? Were they unbiased? Or did they have an agenda that coloured their writing? Just want to point out, though, my four questions are basically the ones he's asked there. I put this handout together when I graduated about quite a long time ago, 15 years ago, and they're just the obvious historical questions to ask. Christians aren't thick people who are used to believing whatever a book says. Christians have been asking these questions of the Bible for thousands of years. So that's what we're going to look at. And the Bible authors, when you ask them, I suggest, come out stunningly well. There is a strikingly large amount of evidence to answer these questions. You need to have your comparisons right. So if you're comparing them to what you read in The Independent this morning or something like that, it won't quite be the same, because you could ring the journalist, you could look at the photos they took yesterday, you could travel to the place where the story took place. But if you compare like for like, the New Testament stands out strongly. So let's try our first question. Do we have what was actually written? So I can't get you a signed copy of Mark, or in the ancient world, they wrote on papyrus leaves that fall apart. But we can compare similar books. So Josephus, on your handout, is about the most similar book we can find. He was a Jewish man, a general actually in the army. He'd fought against the Romans. And he writes his book later in life for a Roman audience. So he's a Jewish man writing for a Roman audience in Greek at about the same time the Gospels are being written. So it's an almost identical period of time, almost identical person writing for an almost identical audience. And we've got no signed copy of him either. His book survives in two collections of excerpts, that's little bits and pieces, and nine complete manuscripts. And the oldest bit we have is a 5th century Latin translation of his work. So that's a gap of 350 years. And after that, to get an actual Greek copy, you need to go to the 10th century. And that is just normal in the ancient world. It's not a problem. It doesn't make classicists or ancient scholars say, oh, no, we can't know what Josephus wrote. That's just normal. They say, it's great. We've got, got some copies, and we can read what he said and know basically what he thought. And that's just normal. Compare that to the New Testament, and you have thousands of manuscripts and fragments from all over the ancient world. That is nothing magic. I'm not claiming kind of God magically intervened like that. The Bible was the most popular book in the Middle Ages and the period before that. So it just means that it was copied massively, distributed massively, huge print run. The thing that will survive our era will be Mills and Boone, because there's just thousands of them. It's that sort of issue. There's lots and lots and lots of Bibles, so more of them are likely to survive. So that means, the fact we've got thousands of them, means we can resolve any differences to really good and standard of happiness. So if you have one of the Gospels that looks like that and says NIV in really small print there, just open it up. The ESV ones are a bit more budget. We've not spent much money on them, and they don't have this. But if, for instance, this one is of John, which if you were here any other Wednesday night, that's the book that is being studied here Wednesday by Wednesday. On page 2 of John, footnote F, it says some manuscripts, but the only or only begotten son. And if you got one of the NIV ones, you could just flick over a few pages, you'd find something that says, but some manuscripts. And that is a sign of strength, huge strength. So for Josephus, you have your eight copies, and you choose which one of those eight you're going to print. And you hope the one you print isn't too kind of, didn't have the kind of lunatic copying it who inserted loads of crazy stuff. Whereas with the Gospels, because you have 5,000 different bits and pieces, so you just pick them all up and compare them. And if it's clear that all the ones in Egyptian have kind of extra bits added in, you go, well, clearly somebody, some monk in Egypt sometime, added in some bits he liked, and we'll discount that. And so that the footnotes come in there when there are kind of genuinely a couple of different versions we're not sure of. And it's a very small percentage of occasions, and typically it's that sort of level of thing. You know, it's a place name or it's an extra word here or there that doesn't alter the sense. The biggest example, again, if you have John, you'll see at the beginning of John chapter 8, which is on page 22 in here, there's a section of 11 verses marked saying the earliest manuscripts do not have 753 to 811. The other most significant one is the end of Mark. And again, if you've got a kind of credible, proper edition of the Bible, it will mark really clearly those surviving, those kind of remaining bits of the manuscripts we're not absolutely sure were written by the authors. And so lots of copies, and there are also copies we have from much earlier than other similar ancient books. So I've put some of those on there. Codex Sinaiticus is just down the road in the British Library, actually. Does it say British Library or British Museum? Does it say Museum? I'm sorry. That's because the British Museum owns that bit of the British Library. But if you go into the British Library and kind of up the stairs and turn left, and there's a big Bible section, and Codex Sinaiticus will be out under a glass cabinet. And even if your Greek is kind of ropey and out of practice like mine, you can kind of roughly read the words. And particularly if it's John, which is easy to read, you can kind of check that the English you've got in your hand is the same as the Greek on there. And that's from 350 AD, so already that's 100 years better than Josephus, and it's in the right language. But you can go much earlier than that. Most of the New Testament in Dublin, bits and pieces of the Gospels in 200, and even little fragments from as early as 125 AD, which is really close to the period when John was written. And additionally to that, it's not as if they ignored the Bible until it came out. This is a copy of the kind of earliest Christian writings, the first sort of 100 years or so, and the index of it is full of quotes from the Bible. So there's a sort of, is that all New Testament? Yeah, so that's all New Testament from one of the authors in here. So they're using these books, quoting them, writing to each other about them. So where they quote them, we can check that nothing's changed and nothing's been altered. So already, just huge reasons to have confidence in this book. The variants in a Bible that you see are a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness. It's a sign that historically we've got a really good range of evidence to go off. Okay, let's try the second question. Could the writers have known the truth? On the sheet there's a kind of range of dates, a kind of timeline. I'm not good enough with Word to draw an actual line in there, but that's where it should go. And you'll see Jesus dies on the cross in 33 AD, and I've put a kind of range of when the books roughly were written. And I should say these are not kind of fascist Christian dates, and these are the consensus dates of modern scholarship. So personally, particularly with John, for instance, personally I would date that significantly earlier than I put it on the sheet. But there isn't positive historical evidence to force you to make it earlier, so most scholars wouldn't put it earlier. I think probably it is the last of the Gospels to be written anyway. So if you look at the gap from the later date for John to be written through to 33 AD, that is a gap of 67 years, which I think, if we did that from now backwards, is that 1943? Have I done that right? So we're in that kind of period of time. So this is the equivalent of somebody today saying the Holocaust didn't happen. It's that period of time. And if we wanted to check whether they were telling the truth or not, we'd just try and find people who were there. So it's a big event, you know, are they right? Did it happen or did it not happen? It's that sort of period of time, not a massive period of time. But actually, we can get much closer than that. So Paul's letters are beginning to be written in 48 years, so by 48 AD. So 15 years ago, that's 1996, isn't it? Anything significant in someone's life happened in 1996? Did anyone get married or anything like that? Or anyone have a child? Or anyone born in 1996? That's always alarming. It's that sort of time scale. And you may well want to say 67 years or 15 years is a long time to remember details like what the weather was like on a given day. But the key thing we're saying is that your best friend was butchered in front of you, crucified. You saw him die, and then 3 days later, you saw him alive again. He cooked you breakfast. He walked along with you. He chatted to you. And I suggest that's the sort of thing that even 15 years later, you'd remember if it happened or not. Particularly as actually, they don't go from nothing to talking about it in 15 years. They are telling the story to each other constantly. And they go around persuading people, persuading each other, standing up and arguing about it all of the time. So it's a short period of time. And they are claiming, and they're claiming to be eyewitnesses. That's quite important. And they're not claiming that they kind of heard about it in Chinese whispers and passed on and passed on. So a quote at the bottom there from Luke's Gospel. Many have undertaken to draw up an account as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the words. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good to me also to write an orderly account for you so that you may know the certainty of the things you've been taught. It's actually an area where Richard Dawkins and I agree absolutely. So Richard Dawkins, in his book, has a real go at Christians who say there shouldn't be evidence for faith. You know, if there's evidence, you destroy faith. You've just got to believe. And he has a real rant at them, rightly, I think. Say, actually, the kind of things Christians are asking you to believe aren't a separate category of knowledge. Again, it's things like, did a dead man rise from the dead? Is Jesus God or not? Who was he? They're all actually normal historical questions. Even if they have a slightly weird kind of extra flavour to them, we're saying God intervened in history, and they're not kind of things you can't have evidence for. And the gospel writers agree with Richard Dawkins. So I put the quote from John on there as well. Testify. We know his testimony is true. Or in Over the Page, 1 Corinthians 15 is one of the earliest records of the resurrection. And he lists a load of witnesses. And actually, we'll look at this on Easter Sunday here in this room, Easter Sunday night, if you can join us. And he includes, there were 500 people who saw Jesus all at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. So again, the push is, if you don't believe me, Paul says, you know who these people are. You can go and ask them, talk to them, ask, did it really happen? Since Dan Brown wrote this book, we probably need to talk a little bit about other Gospels. Who read this or saw the film? Okay, that's grand. Lots of people. I loved it. Took it on holiday, and it's just the sort of book I enjoy because it's kind of, you don't have to think too hard. And in fact, I think the real genius is it's specifically designed so that you get to the puzzles slightly before the characters, even though it's just told you what kind of clever people they are. So, I'm quite clever too. But his kind of line is that there are lots and lots of other Gospels, and that in particular, Constantine, in 325 AD, laid out, if you like, the 80 different Gospels, he says, and picked out which ones will make me powerful. We'll have a bit of Matthew, a bit of Mark, a bit of Luke, and a bit of John. If you trace Dan Brown back to the nearest sort of reputable scholar, you get a woman called Elaine Pagels, who she edited several of what are called the Nag Hammadi documents, teaches at a university in America, and is no fan of Orthodox Christianity. But she's very clear on what the Nag Hammadi Gospels were. So, sorry, there's two sets of very exciting, if you're a geek, discoveries in the 20th century. There's the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are not Gospels, nothing to do with Jesus at all, except as background. They're the kind of library of, imagine a community of Jewish monks, and it's their library, it's that sort of thing. The Nag Hammadi documents are Christian, and they're found in Egypt, and they are... They're sort of library of a slightly weird Christian sect. And they include in them the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel, all those sort of Gospels there. If you go to Elaine Pagels, who is keen on them and likes the ideas in them, and you say, when were they written? She will say that the Nag Hammadi Gospels, written in the middle of the 2nd century, so 150 AD or thereabouts, with the exception of the Gospel of Thomas, which is probably written about when the four Gospels were written, so inside the first century. And that is a crucial difference. So if you remember the Dan Brown thing, that the key theory is that Mary Magdalene was having Jesus' baby in 33 or 34 AD. And here's something I guarantee, if she was having his baby in 34 AD, she was not writing a gospel in 150 AD. So that those gospels, read them for their ideas, to interact with our ideas if you want, but they are clearly not written by people who actually knew Jesus. And the reason they chose the four gospels that they did is because they're the ones with the access to eyewitness material. So Matthew and John both claim to have been apostles. Mark was a bit like Peter's kind of PA, writing out what Peter saw. And Luke, as we just read, he goes around and interviews the other eyewitnesses and puts an account together. Good. So again, how good is this already? My history degree, I worked out the easiest way to have a nice life was to focus, and ideally focus on something that I knew already. So I focused on 1066, which everybody knows. And the sources for the Battle of Hastings, if you're just struggling to keep up, in 1066, here are the sources that I had to study for my special or further subject. There was William of Poitiers, who was not there. There's the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. They were there, and they lost. So you've got a kind of very brief little comment about how unfair it all was. You have the Bayeux Tapestry. Has anyone been forced to go there by your parents? Bayeux Tapestry, made by a bunch of nuns in France a lot later. They weren't there. The kind of fighting nuns of Bayeux, no. William of Jumièges, who copied off somebody else, and Orderic, who wasn't even born. And those are the sources for the Battle of Hastings. And again, that doesn't mean that we say this event is really uncertain. We don't know if it really happened. That's just normal history. You read each one, you say, what's your particular bias? What's going on? You put it all together and you try and work out what's happening. Good. So the Gospels, we have what they wrote, and they did have access to the events. So do we have reason to trust them? This, if you like, is about the internal evidence within the book. Does that give us reason to trust them? What you normally do with a historical document, you would look at the internal evidence and the external evidence. Those are my next two questions. So internal evidence, is their aim, is helpful. We want to provide certainty. We want to provide testimony. That's exactly what you'd want. They don't, it's quite common to hear people saying, well, you know, really, they're shooting for a change in people's lives. So they write a load of fairy stories to try and encourage you to change your life. Be good, be nice, love your neighbour. The gospel writers would not thank you for that description of them. I gave a gospel, I gave to a friend at university called Rebecca. She was studying modern languages, so she had to read 7 or 8 books a week in French or German, something like that. So she knew not the same as concentrating on 1066. She had to do some work. And she brought it back. She read it in an afternoon, which surprised me. And she came back and said, these people really believed what they were writing was true. Interesting, just comment from someone who had to read a lot of books. I think if you read it, you'd find the same. Doesn't mean you have to believe it is true, but they're setting it out as historical, things that happened to me, even though they're weird. Who they were is quite helpful. They're a great mix of people, educated people, less educated people, fishermen, Pharisee, tax collector. They write in different parts of the world with no chance to check their stories with each other. They write at different times. You can see they're selecting which bits of the story they'll put in, just like any journalist would. They're choosing, my audience will like this bit of the story or needs to hear this bit of the story, which again is ideal for a historian. If you can get a range of people writing about the same event, you look at the differences and you get a much better picture of what actually happened. Their audience is significant as well. They're not writing 100 years later when nobody can check what they're saying. They're writing to the people who killed Jesus, hostile to him, but remember the events. They're writing to other Christians who were there and will say, hang on, Jesus didn't say that. I remember, I was there. And they're telling those stories, preaching those stories to each other in that kind of context. So internally, there are some strong reasons to trust them. But also, they're not writing in a vacuum. So our last question, can we corroborate what they wrote? And let's just pick out, I'm going to stop in time for questions, pick out a few little bits of evidence, and then we'll stop for questions. So the very existence of the early church is a piece of data that needs explaining. So the church goes from nothing to an enormous significant movement in a very short period of time. I put on the sheet that in 64 AD, Rome burns down, and Nero is able to get out of a little political hole by blaming Christians for the fire. So again, so 33 AD to 64 AD, that's 31 years. I'm not quite sure what that would be in popular culture. Something like ABBA, is it? 31 years ago. So imagine London burns down, and you need to say there's enough ABBA fans in London, and we hate them, which we do, don't we? We're going to blame them for the fire of London. Or actually, it isn't, you know, Sweden to London isn't so far. You'd actually need a kind of obscure South American panpipe band or something. Something like that. A movement that has spread across the ancient world is so big everywhere that the ruler of the world can blame them for something that's just happened in his city in 31 years. And I think the question for somebody here who isn't a Christian, my question would be, how do you explain that growth, that explosion? So people often say, well, you know, people were gullible then, or you know, maybe they just got really enthusiastic. Fine, we're happy to talk around any kind of alternative theory people want to put forward, but it needs to have evidence to it. It needs to match up with actually the facts. And my suggestion is that if you can find a big event that launched the movement, that really helps you explain why it's there. And obviously in the Christian Gospels you have that big event. You have the death of Jesus making the Christian movement dead, frightened, scared, running away. 3 days later you have a risen Jesus. You know, if you're with the man who can beat death, maybe we can make a go of this. And they go out in confidence and it explodes everywhere. So for instance, how can we prove that archaeologically? 79 AD, a volcano blows up in Italy, buries two cities, Herculaneum and Pompeii, and buried in it are Christians. We find their kind of symbols that they have there, their fish symbols. If you ever see them on the back of cars being driven really slowly and annoyingly or badly and lurchily, that says Christian. That's another thing to hate Christians for. But they're there in those cities. And they also find these things, which are, this is my answer to Dan Brown, a little bit of kind of fun code stuff. It's an acrostic. Do you see it goes R-O-T-A-S across the top? And the same again backwards across the bottom. It's all quite fun. And we think it's a kind of coded, I'm a Christian message. Partly because it comes with the fish symbols and we find them elsewhere. But here's some of the kind of Da Vinci Code fun that goes with it. Some of the words mean Christian things. So Sartor means the sower, one of Jesus, kind of who he is. The other thing is if you take out all the letters, you get enough to say Pater Noster twice, which is the Lord's Prayer, Our Father, Pater Noster. Except for, you have to use the N twice, and you get left with an A and an O left over, which is a bit weird until you spot that you have a lot of A's and O's, and they're always either side of a T. And slightly speculative, but I suggest that is the basic Christian claim, that the Alpha and the Omega, the first and last letters of the Greek alphabet, which is what Jesus claimed for himself, the first and the last, the eternal one, God himself, died on a T, died on a cross. And that's kind of there buried under Vesuvius, sorry, there's one more, in a cross shape, that means he holds. Just bits and pieces like that. Remember, so we get the archaeological backup we would expect. Again, I can't kind of show you Jesus' tomb and the kind of photo of Peter, but we're talking about a minor carpenter, one of several kind of rabble-rousing popular figures who never wrote a book, didn't own any property, didn't leave a kind of bestowed kingdom to anybody. We have the evidence we'd expect as it spreads out. So we've got some Jewish testimony to him from that guy Josephus we talked about. Over the page we've got some Roman testimony to him. Basically bureaucrats saying, what shall we do with these Christians? They're really annoying. Kind of from about 120 AD. You can actually, if you were just to put together the sources we have about Jesus from people who are not Christians, you'd get out this kind of list, that he had a dodgy birth with scandal around it, that his mother was called Mary, that he was a teacher who did miracles, who people said was the Messiah, who was killed under Pontius Pilate, and during his death there was an eclipse or darkness that was weird, that they claimed he rose from the dead, and they claimed he did it on a Sunday. That's the sort of, again, it's not the whole story, but it fits with the account we have in the Gospels. And there's some quite fun things where you may know that about 100 years ago it was quite popular to say that the Bible, the New Testament in particular, was not reliable, that it had been made up much later on and it was full of mistakes and errors. What has just been quite fun is that it's not possible to say that now. And all the kind of scholars' opinions have been rowing backwards from that position, because things like, if you look under archaeology, thing number one, so if you were to turn up John 5 verse 2, John talks about Jesus being in the pool of Bethesda and describes it, how many arches there were and that sort of thing. And they said, well, we know there's no such place. Clear proof that John was writing long after the destruction of Jerusalem. He doesn't have a clue, which is an all right thing to say until 1888, when somebody in a pith helmet puts their spade in it and finds it. And actually, the more of that that goes on, the more you have to say that the only sort of person who could have written this book is somebody who knew Jerusalem well. Jerusalem is destroyed in AD 70. So the only way to have that kind of access to it, geography, facts, place names, even people's names, somebody's done a terrifically dull study of the names of people statistically and finds out the gospel names match Palestinian Judaic names, which is a community that ceases to exist, again, after AD 70. Compare them to diaspora Jewish names, they don't match. Compare them to the period that the gospels are claiming they're written for, they do match. So again, you try and write a novel for a community you've never been in, put in 100 names and try and get them in the right statistical proportions for the people of the time, without knowing that someone in, you know, 2,000 years later with a lot of spare time on their hands was going to count them all from every gravestone and every inscription and every document in the ancient world. That'd be quite hard to do, I suggest. So let me give you a kind of conclusion and then we'll break for questions. I want to say, what other explanation of these books do we have that fits the evidence? We have what they wrote. They were eyewitnesses. We've good reason to think them truthful. Where we can check them, it's accurate. So please read it as history, not as make-believe. And they're biased. They are absolutely biased. Everything in history is. Again, this is GCSE history, isn't it? If you want free marks, you just write, this is biased because, and you get a history GCSE. They tell you they're biased absolutely up front. That I'm trying to persuade you Jesus is God. That's their aim. That's what they want to do. Read it with that bias in mind. They're not long. Mark is shorter than the Daily Mail. Wouldn't take long to read. And the Christian claim is that you could know God as you read it. And that there is, in fact, enough evidence to know God genuinely. Which means, if I can just finish with a slight challenge to you, means that you are culpable for the decisions you make about God. See, if God hasn't left us enough evidence, then it's kind of his fault if I don't believe in him. But if God has left enough evidence, then I need to read it, consider it, and then I'm culpable for the decisions I make out of it. And actually, I think it's also an exciting thing. You can read good historical documents and decide who you think Jesus is and make huge life decisions based on who he is as a result of that. I'm going to stop there. Okay.
Charlie, thanks for the talk. 5,000 copies, but if the original is wrong or inaccurate, then there might as well only have been one copy.
Yeah, thank you. That's right. So that was purely answering question one. Do we have what they wrote? So that doesn't give you any information about whether what they wrote is true. So if they wrote, I saw a pink bunny rabbit and it exploded, or something completely they've made up, that's right. There could be 50,000 copies of that, wouldn't make the event true. It's just evidence that what we have is what they wrote. Does that make sense? So the kind of work they do is they spread them all out, they work out all the different differences, they put them into families, so as in these are all the ones from Byzantium, these are all the ones from the Western Church, these are all the ones in various different languages as they're translated in, so they can track them into families and track back the disagreements. But absolutely right, all it does is tell us that we have what was originally written in 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 AD. That's all it does. But that I think already answers quite a lot of very common objections to the Bible, which is that it's kind of altered, changed, made up much later on. We actually can work out back to, someone kind of estimated 95% of the text we can be absolutely certain of, something like that figure. I don't know quite how you put a number on it like that.
Charlie, on the gospel writer specifically, we've got a few questions on whether they could have made it all up. Could they have lied? The handout says something about them being prepared to die for it. Doesn't that just make them similar to a kind of jihadist who's willing to die in Islam?
Yeah, thank you. So there's the interesting thing, again, about engaging with Dan Brown and with some questions about this is that basically with a Dan Brown's book, and I don't mean to be too pejorative, but it's basically a conspiracy theory, isn't it? So he's saying, his kind of line is, that the truth has been hidden by the Vatican and they have deliberately made stuff like this. And the trouble with a conspiracy theory in history is that you always have to say, well, it could be true. You know, there could be aliens in wherever. There could be lizards that run around under the world and run the world. I think that's David Icke's theory. And you can't, unless you actually look under every rock, you can't absolutely demolish the theory. But you can say, where is the evidence for it? And does it fit the other facts? So the nature of the movement's quite important. They aren't an organized kind of hierarchical organization. So Dan Brown's novels are often about controlling authoritative, secretive organizations. That's one thing that makes his books interesting and gives it a kind of ring of truth. The New Testament church is not like that. They're a bunch of kind of scared blokes who've had some amazing things happen to them, whose message spreads out very rapidly, and it goes with them as they teach and explain it. And they're constantly fighting and arguing, and some of the evidence of that is there in the New Testament documents. It's not a kind of 12 men in a darkened room saying, right, you'll write this, and I'll write this, and right, we're ready to go, let's go. It just doesn't work like that. And in particular, there are kind of features that look like it's true, like the fact they're willing to die for it. And I think the difference with a jihadist or let's pick someone who brilliantly you think will die for what they believe in. Somebody who, I don't know, lays down their life to save someone's life or something like that. They're dying for a principle or something they believe to be true based on things other people have told them. Whereas these guys are specifically dying based on the truthfulness of their own testimony. So they die, some of them, they're given a very direct choice during some of the Roman persecutions. If you will say the emperor is Lord, you can live. But if you refuse to, if you will only say Jesus is Lord, then you must die. And their evidence that Jesus is Lord is, I saw him again when he was risen from the dead. So at that point, if they know it isn't true, they're choosing to give their life away on a lie. Which is different, I think, to me dying for Christianity, because I'm dying for my trust in what they said. Whereas for that first generation, they are specifically dying for the thing they say is true. Does that make sense as a difference? So again, it's not, maybe they had some really strong, powerful reason to want to do that. But I think as you line it all up, you begin to say that looks very unlikely. They look like people who are just driven by things that had happened to them.
Charlie, we had several questions on the gap between the events and them being written down. One of them puts it well. Why is there even a 15-year gap? If I'd witnessed it and felt it was my job to spread the word, I'd write it up the next day.
Brilliant. Thank you. That's really helpful. There are two gaps, actually, on there. So there's the gap we talked about a little bit earlier between the earliest manuscript we have and when the books were written. But this is about the second gap, so between the events of Jesus' life and when they start writing. First thing to say, it's actually not as big as it looks like from what's on there. So I think it's on page 2 of the handout. There is evidence of earlier books than the ones we now have. So the earliest Christian historians writing about Matthew say he based his work on the Logia, a set of Jesus' sayings in Aramaic. And actually the Gospel of Thomas is a book very like that, though it's in Greek. It's a kind of collection of things Jesus said. So maybe that's running around earlier. It's possible they even took notes. Again, they're the Pharisees among them and the tax collectors, literate people who the often rabbis' disciples would have taken notes of what they said. The other thing then to say about the gap is that they wouldn't, I think you're absolutely right, we feel, why not write it down? That's the first thing we do. This you're all taught on your work, if there's an accident or a break-in or something like that, the first thing you do is you write it down and you put it in the book and all that stuff. They didn't think like that. Papias, who's quoted on there, is writing in about, somewhere like 120 AD, and he is crystal clear he'd rather meet an eyewitness than a book. And they have a different cultural presupposition about words. We think written words are the best kind of words. They thought that spoken words were the best kind of words. And again, it's one of those things where you can't just go back to their culture and say, but I'd have done it differently. And the people then, they as long as there are apostles running around speaking to them, that's who they want to go and hear. That's who they prioritize. So the earliest books written are not ordered accounts of the testimony of what happens, they're the troubleshooting letters. So we've been looking here at the letter to the Corinthians, one of the earlier letters, and that is written because the church in Corinth was a disaster. Someone's sleeping with his mother-in-law, they're getting drunk at church, it's all the kind of crazy stuff going on. So he writes the letter not to kind of establish the Christian faith, but to sort out the problem. And they start writing the kind of let's tell you everything that happened books as the earliest apostles begin to die. So that it's a very specific response to the absence of eyewitnesses. As the eyewitness generation begins to disappear, they say, now we must write it down so that you may know the truth of what's been written, so that you will not forget. They say things like that. So that's why the gap's there.
Just on the gap in John's Gospel specifically, I think a lot of us will have noticed, so it says about 95 to 100 AD for John. Life expectancy, do people live that long? John surely would have died before he's supposed to have written his Gospel.
Yeah, thank you. So, again, it depends slightly how much you rate oral church tradition. So the oral church tradition is that John was a very young man when he knew Jesus. So again, if you saw the Da Vinci Codes, in the picture of the Last Supper, he's the one that Dan Brown is saying is actually Mary Magdalene, basically because he looks a bit girly, is the idea. So he's a very young man, smooth face, not big beard, and that is the kind of the everywhere that we have evidence of John from early on. They're saying really young guy who lived to an old age, didn't get killed like lots of the other apostles, was exiled, kind of prison exiled to an island called Patmos. And that's where he wrote his letters and the book, the Revelation, and his Gospel. So 95 is probably, let's just do the math. So if he's 20 in 33 AD, how old is he in 95? I can't do the math. 70 plus 20, 82 or 92?
82.
So it's just about possible. There are two options you can do with that. Richard Baucom, who's the guy who's piggybacked on the boring person with the place names, he therefore says probably John was written by a different John called John the Elder, who's a kind of second generation John, or I think you say probably the book was written earlier. And those are two possible options. That's right. So the dating does have an influence on that. The timeline's there to say even the kind of consensus dates put you within the lifetime of people who know and remember Jesus. That's the idea of those.
Several questions on the so-called Gospels that weren't included in the Bible. Could you just say a bit more about them, Thomas, Mary, why they weren't included?
Yeah, loved it. Can we do a few more pictures? Is that possible? Well, let's break if I balance it on my lap. Press B. How's that? And B again. Lovely. That's the kind of Dan Brown picture, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John and Tom, Dick and Harry and people like that. Or actually, they said there were 80. And that he was picking in 325 AD. There's, as with every good conspiracy theory, there is a sense to which Dan Brown has it right. So 325 is a very significant year. Constantine's influence is very important. He's the one who makes Christianity legal for the first time. And he does try and shape the movement in order to get political gain out of it. All that is absolutely true. And it is also true that in about that period, actually not in 325, but actually around it, they were making decisions about which books should be in the New Testament. The bit that Dan Brown has wrong is that they're choosing Gospels at that point, or even that they're choosing significant numbers of books. So that list there are the books that we know they were confident about across the ancient world by 200 AD. So for different books we could go earlier than that, but that's the kind of core Christian books that are believed everywhere. Again, remember, it's not an organized kind of controlled religion. It's more like, we've got this book called 1 Corinthians. It's brilliant. Do you want to read it? It's by Paul. And so it gets copied and it spreads kind of erratically like that. But these were books that were believed everywhere. Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, Acts, which is the earliest kind of Christian history, Paul's epistles, and some of the books towards the end of the Bible. Which means you have a second list of books that they weren't sure about everywhere. So there would have been churches that read those ones and thought they were authoritative and were in the Bible, and there'd have been other churches that were kind of, we've never heard of them, and other churches still who were, well, those books are a bit weird, not sure who they were by, and weren't so sure. And in addition, there's a list of books that, a bit like the top list, that some churches thought were in the Bible, even though now we don't have them in the Bible. And the thing you notice, can I do this without breaking this? The thing you notice about them is that there are no Gospels in that list. and certainly none of the Gospels that Dan Brown is excited about. They are they're kind of nice books of Christian instruction by early Christians. Some of them are in here. So the letters of Clement are in there. Some of them are in here, things like the Didache and some of the other ones, the Shepherd of Hermas. And basically, I'd encourage you to, if that's your question, encourage you to read them. And there's nothing kind of scary, changes what you believe about Jesus in them. They're kind of Christian good advice, like get out of bed and brush your teeth and read the Bible and that sort of be nice to your bishop. And it's that sort of level of stuff that's in there. And so what they're doing in 325 AD, once there's an emperor who wants his official religion to be all neat and tidy, is they're tidying up this issue. And if you graph out what they did, here's the New Testament by length of books, so Matthew, Mark, Luke and John from the left because they're the big fat ones, up to the little letters at the end. If we take out all the ones that were on that list of ones they weren't sure of everywhere, what we get is a kind of that much that you'd leave out. So there's some there, but there it's a very small percentage of the books in the Bible. So again, if that's a question that interests you or troubles you, I'd say start with the ones they were sure about everywhere. So read your way through Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, Acts, all of Paul's letters, and some of these other ones. And then once you've made a decision about Jesus based on them, then maybe you can think again about these ones over here. Does that make sense? And sorry, no, there was another part of the question. What were they deciding on? And the basic decision was always who wrote it. And do we know who wrote it and how do we know who wrote it? So they wanted books that were by apostles or by people in that category. So Mark gets in because he's writing up Peter's sermons and teaching. And people like James get in because they're Jesus' brother and running the church in Jerusalem. It's that category of people. So it's who wrote it, which again is a great question for our purposes because it approximates to could they have known who those people, the events of Jesus' life.
Good. Charlie, we've got 5 minutes left. Sorry. So we don't want you getting too excited about these questions. Give us a sentence on these documents that have been discovered in Jordan. There's a few questions on them. Do you know about them?
No. Which ones? Name them. Have we got... When? Where were they?
It's Christian relics. It was in the metro the other day. I saw that. Anyone know any more about that?
Does someone speak about them? Whose question? If three people ask that question, please tell us about them, if you want to.
No, we'll have to look that one up. What about, so there's been a programme on recently, this archaeologist woman, there was a couple of questions about the Old Testament as well. Yeah. So she's saying some of the stuff about David's kingdom. I mean, how do you react? Yeah. Have you got all the stuff saying, no, I know the Old Testament's reliable as well? Or how do you react?
Yeah, no, so much, so the particularly the corroboration is harder and harder to do the further and further you go back in time. Just because things get destroyed, things are blown up, things get lost. So the further back you go, the harder it is to do. And we can do some of the same work where the kingdom of Israel interacts with other major kingdoms that kept records. It's sort of patchy. So things like, the big miracle like crossing the Red Sea, you wouldn't expect much archaeological evidence of that. You know, some water went this way, they walked through and it closed over again, splash. But you would expect evidence of lots of people with different customs arriving in a new land. So you're looking for that kind of level of evidence. See if it matches up. The other complication about much older history is that they don't date things using years, and they date things using kings. So they'll say, this is the third year of X king, if they bother to give you that much information, or during the years of Billy. And so to work it out, you just have to rack up the list of kings. So here are all the kings of Egypt, and here are all the kings of Babylon, and okay, there's two that are contemporary, so roughly speaking, we're in the same period here. So there's scope for massive disagreement about this archaeological pot that I find here. Does it belong here or does it belong 500 years earlier? But so can I show you some pictures on that?
Go on.
Just very briefly. So the Old Testament stuff, here's the British Museum, and here's some kind of things. So this is the Moabite stone, where people paying tribute to an impressive Near Eastern ruler, and there is Jehu, king of Israel, bowing down to pay his tribute. So someone mentioned in the Bible. There is the Lachish stone, talking about the siege of a Jewish city, event mentioned in the Bible. Here, in fact, are some pictures to go with it. I think that's a slightly later siege of Lachish. But here are Jewish captives fleeing from the city. Here they are being flayed alive. Here they are bowing down to the great king. I can't remember which these are. I think those are messages from the city as it's being besieged. Come and bring help. I think stuff like that, you get the first ever Yahweh, the name for God, written out on it. There is the Cyrus cylinder, which is one of the odd things that happened in the Bible, is that the Jewish people are taken out of Israel, scattered around the empire, and then suddenly an emperor says, go home, all of you, go home, I'll be really nice to you, build your temple. And you think, yeah, come on. But then you find things like the Cyrus cylinder, you find out he did it to everybody. He was fed up of big racial conflicts in his kingdom. He thought, let's just send them all home. So that's, and this is him.
Where's the writing? Is that the writing around here?
Yeah, that's right.
It's looks like a loafer.
You put a piece of paper on it, you cover it in ink, and you roll it on a piece of paper, and you've got your charter. So it's kind of instant printing. And that's sending a different group home. This, that's the Gilgamesh story of, so story very like the floods. So story with two people in a boat who get rescued from a great big flood. It's a Babylonian epic of the same kind of event. So that's sort of patchy. By the time you're back here, we're so far back. You know, it's amazing we can even read it. But sort of patchy corroboration. But nothing like, we're not in the kind of imperial technological age of Rome then. So it's much harder to do it.
Great. Two very quick questions. You're not allowed to show us any pictures.
No more pictures. No more pictures.
Contradictions within the different gospel accounts?
Yeah, thank you. So contradictions, where they come, are a problem for me as a Christian who believes the Bible is all true. But they're not a problem for you investigating the historicity of the New Testament. They're in fact perfect for that that purpose. So again, you think if you were on a jury, or if you were a barrister or something, if you meet the people who all tell exactly the same story, you know there's something wrong with it. I think actually if you were to read the four Gospels laid out, most of the contradictions are not the kind of problem that you think they were in terms of at a truth level. These are people chopping and changing the order events happening. They make no claim to be telling an absolute strict historical order. They're telling it from the perspective of what they most want to say. So they leave stuff out. They emphasize different bits in it. So if Jesus gives a long sermon and three different people give you the excerpts from it, you do get three quite different points sometimes. I don't think that's a problem. That's, again, they're just, if you wrote, if all of you now went away and wrote down, what did Charlie say? Half of you wouldn't have a clue because you'd be asleep and you know, whatever, but there would be kind of different edited versions. There are one or two of them that are on my list of things that for me as a Christian are a problem, things that I'm kind of working on. And my general experience with things on that list has been, as I know more about them, as we discover more about them or the background or the history, that actually we find out they resolve. There's a couple left on my list that aren't resolved, and I'm choosing to kind of stick with the mass of evidence that says these are reliable accounts, and that Jesus is God, rather than a couple of things I don't know how to answer yet.
Right. And then final question, Charlie. If the writers weren't aiming to create a body of moral teaching, I think you said that, why do Christians treat the New Testament as if it is that? And then what makes Christians go to the greater extent of basing their life on the gospel? Maybe you could answer that one personally.
Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, that's right. So what I meant to say was they're not making up any old fairy story in order to get moral truth out the other end. How will we make the world a nicer place? I know, we'll invent a man who did miracles and was nice to children and rose from the dead. That's not the way around they're doing it. But what they're saying is, here is what happened to us. We met God. That's exactly how John opens his gospel and how he opens his letter. His first letter opens, that which we touched and saw and heard, that was that which was from the beginning. The being that predates time, we shook hands with him. And that, John says, changes everything. If you've met God, if you've met the man who made you, the person who knows how you should behave, who knows what you're made for, knows where your life will work best, then you listen to him. If he is truth, if he has rights over you, if he loves you, cares for you, was interested enough in you to come and be a human being. Again, imagine even a much smaller jump. So the jump from God to us is pretty enormous. Imagine a much smaller jump, like from you to a London rat. And if the rats in your house were in trouble, would you agree to become a rat if that would somehow help them out? Again, it's interesting, in dialogue with people from other religions, they will say this often, particularly Muslim friends who care very strongly about God's otherness and the importance of God's majesty, to say God becoming a human being, that's degrading. And the gospel writers say, yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? That Jesus would care enough about me that that he gave up living in heaven in his throne room and said, I'll become like you so that I can die for you while people like you spit at you, spit at me and kill me so that I can rescue you. So the truth stuff gets me to Jesus and who he is. I think there's nothing else that fits the evidence except that he is God's. If he is God's, then I'm astounded by what he says and what he did, and I want to follow him.
Charlie, thanks so much. It's been really interesting and useful.